Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information available on all that Carthage offers at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we're going to find out about how some Quakers from the Kenosha and Racine area took part in this recent election and in events going forward. In part two, we'll hear from the author of an interesting book called Diversifying Power, which calls for many more women to be part of the movement to combat climate change and other global threats. Stay with us. And for this portion of WGTD's morning show, we're going to be talking about an interesting project, if you will, that is underway all across the country, and it was underway even before Election Day, and is certainly in place in the aftermath of this tumultuous election. Of course, the final results of which are still being processed, but we're going to be talking for the next few minutes with Belinda Thielen, who is a Quaker fellow, if I understand correctly, with the Racine Kenosha Quakers. We'll get clarification on that in just a moment. And Belinda Thielen recently attended via Zoom a workshop which I believe was called Choose Democracy. And the purpose of this workshop, which involved hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people from all across the country, was to talk about ways in which the integrity of this election process could be maintained and sustained, and moreover, that the integrity of our very democracy could also be sustained in all kinds of different ways in the face of what some see as potential moves to usurp our democratic norms and processes in the form of what some might even call a coup. And of course, it's not all that often in our history, and very seldom in recent history, that the term coup gets thrown around or talked about with any seriousness. But there are plenty of people who are thinking about this possibility and exploring ways to resist it. And so this is what Belinda Thielen was part of with this a Zoom workshop and a follow-up workshop as well. And we're going to be talking with Belinda Thielen about this for the next few minutes. Belinda Thielen, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So first of all, since I'm not Quaker and not very deeply steeped in the details of what it means to be a Quaker, just summarize whatever you think is helpful for us to know in this conversation, and also the role that you play with the local group of Quakers.
Okay. So Quakers believe, have one central belief that guides us in whatever else we do, and that is that there is the divine in each person. There's the way we say it is, there is that of God in each person. And we don't own that idea. That's a pretty universal idea. But we use that to guide us in our understanding of the world, of the mystical parts of the world and the practical parts of the world. And that is a very simple but very difficult concept to be guided by. And so we support each other in that. I guess the other things that are important to understand about Quakers is that we do not have any particular spiritual leader. There's no pastors, there's no priests, that we each believe that our relationship with God is a personal relationship that we're responsible for. And we hold each other accountable, but we don't tell each other how to think or what to think. So that's Quakers. So when we act as a group, which can be, as you can imagine, pretty difficult thing to do if no one is guiding us or telling us what to do. And that's what made this particular project fairly unusual for us, is that we generally act individually by our own lights. And in this case, we decided we might be more responsible to our community, to our values, if we acted as a group. And so we made a commitment to learn about this movement, to protect democracy, to preserve our democracy and the integrity of the voting process, and acted together on it. And one of the things that we learned from that was how much more powerful we can be, or we were able to be, when we acted together. The other thing that I think is important about this project is that it is, well, it's consistent with who we are as Quakers. It is consistent with who everyone is in a democracy, that we're just a group of ordinary people. And that I hope in this discussion, people who are listening to this get a sense that, oh, this is what ordinary people do these days. This is part of our responsibility, just as simple citizens or as simple participants in a democracy. It is not a situation such as with the pandemic, where we need to listen to the experts and follow the advice of scientists. This is something where we listen to our internal understanding of what a democracy is, and we move with in our capabilities to defend it.
Is this something that has long been a hallmark of Quakers? I mean, have Quakers traditionally or through our country's history been participants in this respect, or is this relatively new or maybe a relatively uncommon occurrence?
What an interesting question. Quakers, we do have a history of being guided by that respect for the divine in each person, which makes us pacifists. Quakers have historically taken a stand against war. We have historically taken a stand against slavery. And so it's very consistent with our values to take a stand on behalf of every voice being heard, every vote being counted.
We're speaking with Belinda Thielen, who is with the local group of Quakers in Kenosha and Racine. And at the top, I introduced you as a Quaker fellow because that's how you were introduced to me when I first found out about you. Is that who you are? Should I call you a Quaker fellow? And if so, what does that mean?
It's a great term. I've never heard it before.
Oh.
Quakers tend to use some funny language. We also are known as the Society of Friends. So we refer to each other as friends, which I think is a really confusing term because you can't see the capitalization on the word. We don't tend to use titles. So I call myself a Quaker because I am sort of proud of that affiliation. But other than that, I'm not sure there's a good title for it.
So you're certainly a very active member of the Quaker community in the Kenosha Racine area, and certainly it sounds like you've taken a central role in participating in this recent workshop, again titled Choose Democracy. Describe in a little more detail for our listeners what that workshop was about, what was shared, and what was kind of at the heart of it.
Right. So this is the important information. The president did something very unusual a few months ago in terms of tipping his hand and very openly saying, or leading us to believe that he was not committed to a peaceful transfer of power or peaceful transition. And that created a real sense of alarm among many people. And so there was a group, this group Choose Democracy, some other groups met and started to talk about, well, what can we do if there is an undemocratic power grab? And this group Choose Democracy did some, I think, very smart and very profound work by looking at the history of coup attempts across the world and how did citizens defeat those coup attempts successfully and sometimes unsuccessfully. And they developed four keys. They said there are four things that are important for all of us to understand if there is a threat of an undemocratic power grab, that this any response has to be swift, it has to be broad-based, there have to be clear alliances, broad alliances among people who don't generally think of themselves as allies. There has to be strict nonviolent discipline, and that's a strategic decision, not a philosophical decision in this situation or in this case. And all of this has to be, there has to be a deep commitment of a refusal to recognize illegitimate authority. And if these pieces can be in place, then there's a possibility that we never have to use them, that the best way to defeat a coup is by never having one. And I actually saw a recent analysis by a law professor at Georgetown saying there's less reason to be afraid of an undemocratic power grab now because so many thousands of people did prepare so that there is that groundwork that has been laid so that people maybe will never have to use this preparation.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of interesting to think about in this transparent world in which we live with so much connectedness, I mean, which can cause all kinds of pain and problems and so on. But it also means that very little, in fact, happens behind tightly shut doors and that, I mean, it's very difficult to achieve that kind of veil of secrecy in this day and age. That being said, that doesn't mean that certain plans couldn't be laid and set into motion, and that's one of the reasons why these concerns are being raised. I know that one of the people that was really leading this workshop was someone by the name of George Lakey,
yes,
who himself is a Quaker and who has written extensively about this. Briefly, just tell us a little bit about his words of wisdom or the role that he plays in this.
So George Lakey, I felt really privileged to be able to attend two of the workshops that he presented. George Lakey was a figure during the civil rights movement in the 60s, helping use the strategy of nonviolence. He is a Quaker, so he also philosophically believes in nonviolence. But he clarified for us some really important points, one of which was we're not using the same tactics that are used in the struggle for social justice, for example, that this is a different game. We're playing by different rules. And what we're doing here is not opposing an enemy. We are supporting each other and bringing in the center, that the critical nature of the center, the people who normally would sit by and let this play out, let something play out, are the people who are critical to this process. And so George, I just felt that he was very clear about that. He was very adamant about nonviolent discipline. We're not looking for trouble. We're not looking for conflicts or confrontations with the Proud Boys or with the militia. They are on the sidelines. They are not. And this is not about Trump. This is broad-based people who believe in democracy, being willing to stand for democracy. And George is tough. He didn't just say, oh, we'll be in the streets and we'll demonstrate with signs. He said, the part where people go and they demonstrate in public is an indication that there will be an unwillingness to cooperate with an illegitimate regime. Mm-hmm. That people are saying is, we're here, but this is not where it stops. We will not go to work. We will not participate in an illegitimate power grab. Mm-hmm. I think it was his experience and his knowledge were critical to bringing people together and laying out a path for us of how we can move forward in an effective way.
My understanding is that you and some of your fellow local Quakers were involved in a letter writing campaign in recent days. Tell us about those letters, what they said, and to whom they were sent.
Yeah, so that was what we did. That was our first action that we agreed to do. And we have this one wonderful member of our meeting who we spent 2 days researching all the local village and town and city elected officials and their contact information. And we sent them letters simply saying who we are and calling on them to use their capacity to ensure that all democratic norms are respected and to say that publicly, that that will be their position. And I think this was perfect for Quakers because what we do is we try very quietly to hold people accountable to their responsibility as they see it. And it was good for us to do this. We also sent a letter to local police chiefs saying, please remember and respect your requirement to defend people's right to constitutional right to free speech. I think our message was, we very respectfully ask you to think deeply and seriously about your responsibility to everyone. And we got responses. We didn't just get wrote letters back, boilerplate types of letters back. We got personal responses from people, from the elected officials who we wrote to, saying, yes, I take my responsibility seriously, and I promise you, every vote will be counted.
Partly answers the question I wanted to ask, which was to these elected officials your letter referred to, asking them to ensure that the democratic norms take place. So what are we talking about, those kind of norms? It sounds like one of them is that every vote be counted.
And I think that's the thing that we're focusing on right now. I know there's a lot more to be discussed about what are the democratic norms, but for the purposes of having a broad, understandable message that everyone can be part of, it can agree to, the message right now is count every ballot. That's important. That's the important message.
Where do you see this going from here? I mean, given the fact that, I mean, first of all, of course, the results of this current presidential election are still in process and still have to be finalized. And of course, what occurs from that point on is also uncertain at this point. Given all of that uncertainty, what is your sense of what the next response might be, and how is this going to look? How is this going to work? I mean, when we're talking about something that does not have a leader, a governing body sort of deciding what happens next or what our response exactly will be.
What a great question. And I think many, many people are asking ourselves, we don't know what's going to happen, and we don't know what action is going to be needed. And there are coordinating bodies. There are some very good coordinating bodies. Choose Democracy is one of them. Protect the Results is another. Hold the Line is another. And I think one of the things that they're being very careful about is not to overreact. We have not had a coup. It was not a coup when President Trump tweeted out that he was the winner. It was very much of an undemocratic action, and it was a red flag, but it wasn't a coup. And so I think what we're going to rely on these organizations for is to keep us informed about what is really going on and how to understand what is going on. And then we're going to have to use our best judgment to work together. What they recommend, what George Lakey recommends, is work together in small groups of people who you know and who you trust so that you can avoid the possibility of provocation to violence or that kind of thing, and show up. Don't just show up at, it doesn't have to be in Times Square. It can be in front of your local city hall. And don't look for confrontation, but look to be seen and be heard. And Quakers, sometimes we just look to be seen. We do something that's called a silent witness. And sometimes that's more effective than shouting slogans, to each their own that way. But show that we are a united country for protecting our democracy. And the ways we do that and what we'll be called upon to do are unknown at this point. I know many, many unions are preparing to have perhaps rolling work stoppages, some kinds of strikes. We don't know what we'll be called upon to do. Hopefully, it will be nothing. Hopefully, there will be a peaceful transition.
Well, we of course wait with bated breath to see what happens next. And in the meantime, it's been very interesting to hear about some of the work being done with groups like Choose Democracy, the Indivisible Project, to Stand Up America, and others. And Belinda Thielen, part of the local community of Quakers in the Kenosha and Racine area, I appreciate you joining me today on the morning show for this conversation. Thank you so much, and best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We're about to explore the concepts outlined in a new book called Diversifying Power: Why We Need Anti-Racist Feminist Leadership on Climate and Energy. It is the contention of the author of this book, Jenny C. Stevens, that the leadership that is in place right now, especially in this country and probably in most parts of the world, is too much dominated by white males. And because of that, many of the perspectives are perhaps limited. And also the understanding of the impact of some of these problems are somewhat limited. And that if we had a more diverse leadership when it comes to these kind of issues, we would have a wider ranging and more comprehensive understanding about what is going on and about what needs to be done. Jenny Stevens explores this thoroughly in this new book, which is published by Island Press.
She is a professor and the director of the School of Public Policy and Urban Affairs at Northeastern University. And she is a hardworking social justice advocate and researcher when it comes to sustainability science. Again, her new book is titled Diversifying Power: Why We Need Anti-Racist Feminist Leadership on Climate and Energy. Jenny C. Stevens, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you very much, Greg. Great to be able to have this conversation with you.
So you end the preface of your book by saying that you were inspired to write this book because of having gained a distinct sense of optimism. That might come as a surprise to some people. It seems like a lot of books that are about this topic do not necessarily find themselves generated from optimism, but you are feeling optimistic about some things and even around some of the concerns which you directly address in your book. Tell us about that optimism.
Yeah, so we are in a very hard time right now where all of these interconnected crises with the pandemic, with the climate crisis, with economic crisis, and this racial structural racism crisis all coming together and being revealed in ways that is really hard, and a lot of people are suffering and it's a hard time. But I have optimism, and the book talks about, really elevates the potential and what's happening with new emerging leaders, particularly younger leaders and women and people of color who've been historically excluded from leadership spaces are being heard more clearly and being able to contribute. And when this is with this shift, we are seeing that people bring different perspectives, and they bring different life experiences, different perceptions of risk, and that informs different priorities and a sense of connection among all of these challenges. So when I talk about the optimism, what I'm talking about is right now we are seeing social movements and advocates building coalitions among these different issues and calling for larger societal change. And that's really what we need, because business as usual has not been working for so many people. And being able to center social justice at the core of all of our policies and all of our processes is essential.
Hmm. I want to make sure that I give you a chance to touch on something you mentioned in the book that maybe isn't precisely on the target, and yet it's really closely related. And that is the fact that you not only see a problem with a lack of diversity when it comes to leadership in these various movements, but also there is also going on something which you call climate isolationism. Explain what climate isolationism is and why it is a problem in your mind, and also what the connections might be with this lack of diversity in these various movements. Is that isolationism partly due to this lack of diversity?
Yeah, so I've been working on climate and energy for my whole career, so a couple decades now. And what I've become more and more aware of is, and why we've been so ineffective at addressing the challenges of climate change, is this kind of narrow technocratic lens, thinking about science and technology and thinking about investing in technological innovations, but thinking about climate as like a problem that's separate from everything else. And really, it's integrated and connected with everything from our economic system, our jobs, our health, our housing, our transportation. Everything is impacted by the climate. So we've really, by focusing too much on technologies and by focusing too much on kind of this technocratic focus on decarbonization and greenhouse gas emission reductions, and it's not a very inclusive way to elevate a problem or the solutions to it, because it really has excluded a lot of people, and it doesn't connect with what people wake up every day worrying about. So we've also missed opportunities for connecting climate to everything else, and therefore we've also missed opportunities to think about the social change and the social justice issues that we can, as we respond to the climate crisis, we can simultaneously be investing in our communities and providing a better future for everybody in a more prosperous and sustainable future.
Hmm. We're speaking with Jenny C. Stevens about her book, Diversifying Power, Why We Need Anti-Racist Feminist Leadership on Climate and Energy. So explain to us the current state of affairs in terms of how serious the problem of lack of diversity is. I don't mean how serious are the consequences of that, but just how non-diverse is the leadership when it comes to areas of concern like climate and energy.
Well, from my own experience, being a woman working in the energy space and many of the climate experts that I've been trained by, have a kind of scientific lens and background. And as we know, science and engineering is very much dominated by men. And there's been, efforts. Not everybody has access to scientific and education, and so I think it's a problem, and it also really speaks to the limits of how we've been thinking about the problems. And I introduce and discuss in the book this idea of energy democracy, which is really thinking about beyond a technological substitution as we move away from fossil fuels to a renewable-based future. We have the possibilities to invest in kind of regionally appropriate mix of renewable-based energy, not just wind and solar, but for communities on the coast, you could also have wave and tidal energy or an offshore wind. Inland, you could have geothermal energy as well as wind and solar at multiple different scales, including community and locally owned and managed and controlled energy. So what we want to be thinking about is not just the demographics of the people involved, but also the geography and the space and the configurations of our energy systems. And one of the things that's really critical to understand that isn't always clear to people is that the worsening climate crisis and the slow pace of kind of our transformation away from fossil fuels to a renewable-based future has really been intricately connected to economic injustice and the widening income and wealth gap. If you think about the top 1%, many of them are polluter elites. Some people are referring to them in terms of shareholders, fossil fuel interests, executives who are making a lot of money off of the current fossil fuel-based system, and they actually have been, for decades, been strategically investing to resist any changes in that, and through multiple strategies, including a misinformation campaign to deny climate science and the fact that burning fossil fuels has all kinds of negative impacts for all of us, but also investing in undermining public trust in government and worker protections and health protections and really minimizing worker rights. And there's been a shift in corporate culture towards shareholder priorities rather than worker priorities. And this is, we don't always think about this economic injustice as related to the climate crisis, but it really is because there's been a very intentional effort to resist the changes that we need and resist the kinds of investments in our communities that we need.
Hmm. And it's interesting that you coined refer to the term of resistance. And you talk at one point in your book about resistance in the other direction in terms of resisting those who would try to keep the status quo as unchanged as possible. I mean, who who do not welcome these kind of transformative changes. And you say at one point, resistance is not a moderate position. Explain what you're saying there.
Yeah, so one of the things that I've been realizing more and more is that when we are complacent and just kind of do business as usual and don't acknowledge how what we're doing is actually exacerbating inequities or contributing to increasing the racial disparities and other inequities in our society, we are actually contributing to it. So I think one of the important things is that we all need to be considering our own contributions, but more importantly, how the systems that we all contribute to and our practices and the way we organize ourselves and our society is actually, exacerbating inequities and disparities. So the opportunity really is for all of us we have to be intentional about integrating anti-racist and feminist principles into everything we're doing. And that's where, when I talk about diversifying power and the need for anti-racist feminist leadership, it's not only the representation and the actual backgrounds that people bring, but people, men and women and people of all religions and races and cultures can embrace anti-racist feminist principles. And what that really means is a people's first approach. What do people need? What do communities need? And how are we investing to make sure that people have access to the basic things that everybody needs? And we've really moved away from that in the United States in particular, in part because of the powerful concentration of wealth and power of the polluter elite.
One of the most significant elements of your book are some of the success stories thus far. That is, leaders, when it comes to climate and energy, who are the kind of leaders that you are talking about and who have made a difference in their particular part of the world. Share with our listeners a couple of the maybe most vivid and exciting examples of what I'm talking about.
Absolutely. So the book really showcases a lot of different leaders doing a lot of different things, connecting climate energy to jobs, health, transportation, housing, and health, and food access, and other things. So among some of the most exciting and inspiring leaders was Virginie Prakash, who is one of the leaders of the Sunrise Movement, which is the youth movement that has been advancing the agenda for the Green New Deal and is really focusing on connecting climate with jobs and this economic justice. And especially for young people right now, they look to the future and it doesn't look so positive, right? And I myself have two daughters, 19 and 21, and they're really scared about the future. And that's what Varshini Prakash, who's one of the leaders of Sunrise Movement, has really mobilized and youth and collaborated and built coalitions and involves training, and there's local hubs all around the country, and it's really an impressive way to demonstrate this potential of kind of this collective action that so many people can embrace. Another leader is Jackie Patterson of the NAACP. She heads up their environmental and climate justice program, and she and her team have been doing really important and impactful work revealing how fossil fuel interests have been manipulating and co-opting Black communities in particular to get support for their fossil fuel-based projects and oftentimes in very sneaky ways in terms of providing support for those communities, but those communities are then being very negatively impacted in terms of health and economics. So another leader that I emphasize is Jacinda Ardern, who's the Prime Minister of New Zealand, and this relates to the pandemic. New Zealand is one of the countries that has been the most effective in managing the coronavirus and other women-led countries, including Taiwan, Germany, and Denmark, have similarly been very successful. And one of the reasons that it seems to be that the leadership is demonstrating here is, looking at the evidence and getting advice from the experts and taking swift, strict action, and then communicating with empathy and compassion why we need to follow these strict protocols, and then connecting that with saying it's not just about the health of you and your family, but it's actually about the collective health of our community or of our nation. And when a trusted leader is able to communicate that to the people, and people trust that information and they understand this collective well-being for themselves, their families, and their community and their country, we see very different results. And that's another example of the kind of leadership that I think we need more of.
Right, the so-called squad, and your book calls for an expansion of the squad of these kinds of leaders that are making such a difference. Interestingly enough, although your book is very much focused on the present and the future, you take more than one opportunity in the book to evoke the name of Shirley Chisholm, who, of course, famously ran unsuccessfully for the Democratic nomination for president back in 1972. But someone whose legacy is perhaps even more deeply appreciated now than it was when Shirley Chisholm was an active member of our political scene. And explain why you like to remember Shirley Chisholm and why she is an inspiration for you and others in this particular battle and issue.
Absolutely. So the first Black woman to run for president in 1972, she remains an inspiration to so many people. In some ways, we've come a long way since 1972, and in other ways, not so much, right? But she prioritized, what people need as the people's first approach at that time, and she also had a slogan in her campaign, unbought and unbossed. Very much acknowledging how the power of money and the importance of being independent from that. So you mentioned the squad as the four junior congresswomen who've come on the stage just the past couple of years and really changed the discourse, the national discourse in many ways, not just with climate and energy and AOC's leadership on the Green New Deal, but also Ayanna Pressley, who is my congresswoman here in Massachusetts. She has connected transportation equity issues with climate and energy, and also Ilhan Omar in Minnesota has been a strong advocate for the housing connections and the need to invest in public housing. We have a housing insecurity crisis in this country without a plan to deal with it. And now with the pandemic, as many of us know, the evictions and homelessness is growing in very scary and dangerous ways without a real strategy there. So what's happening is we're seeing right now in this period of unprecedented disruption all of these problems coming together. And I think one of the things that we also need to acknowledge is that part of the reason we have all these problems coming together at this time is because we've had leadership that literally has been denying that we have a climate crisis, denying that we have an economic injustice and economic crisis, denying that we even have a health crisis and that the pandemic is even that bad, and then also denying that we have structural racism and a racial justice crisis in this country. So when you deny denial is a strategy to keep things the same, right? If you tell people, no, these aren't problems that you need to worry about, just keep doing what you're doing, you know, we've gotten to the point right now where that denial isn't working because it's right in front of us, and we can see that the realities of all of these issues are very clear.
Right. This is prompting a question I wasn't going to ask you, but I think I do want to ask it. There is, of course, those who flat out, you know, deny the severity of a problem or so on. And then there are others who, in a sense, deny the problem in a different way, and in a way that kind of perhaps diverts our attention. And it brings to mind an interesting story, a personal story you tell in the preface about you and your then husband towards the end of your 19-year marriage. You asked your husband, point blank, you say, my soon-to-be ex-husband, whether he considered himself to be a feminist, in much the same way that someone might ask somebody, do Black Lives Matter? Explain to our listeners what his answer was and what that answer says. And why that answer, why this story is relevant to some of the concerns you raise in this book.
Yeah, thank you for asking that. He, when I asked if he considered himself a feminist, he said he considered himself a humanist, not a feminist. And as you mentioned, you know, that's quite similar to people who respond to the movement for Black Lives and say all lives matter, not just Black lives. And the reason that is a disappointing answer is because the reason we have a feminist lens and the reason people are standing up for the movement for Black lives is because an acknowledgement of the structural oppression that both women and Black Americans in particular have been experiencing for so long. So when somebody equates and says all of us matter, which is of course true, everybody does matter, but it's diminishing and not respecting the challenges and the historical oppression and the systems that have created the inequities that are very clear. So it's a dismissive response that fails to recognize and acknowledge the challenges. So I think that is, it comes back to my point that we all need to embrace an anti-racist feminist set of principles and perspective, regardless of who we are, where we're coming from, as we move toward a more equitable and just society. We all need to acknowledge that it hasn't been a level playing field in any way, shape, or form, and that we need to prioritize and acknowledge the loss of for so long of opportunities for so many people.
The book again is Diversifying Power: Why We Need Anti-Racist Feminist Leadership on Climate and Energy, published by Island Press, the author, Jenny C. Stevens. Professor Stevens, I appreciate you joining me today on the morning show to talk about your very interesting book. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you. Tomorrow on the morning show, a couple of different interviews, including one with Brian Marescu, author of The Immortality Key, The Secret History of the Religion with No Name. It is his contention that the use of psychedelics has been common practice in a number of different notable religions all around the world. A really intriguing book and intriguing story. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information at all that Carthage offers is available at carthage.edu. We're approaching 9 o'clock.